When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Paranorm Girl podcast. I am your host, Kristen. I am not what you would call a paranormal investigator, though I have collected evidence from some pretty spooky joints, a haunted asylum and hospital from the 1800s, a funeral home converted to a modern office space, a post office, a tombstone bordello recently, and in just 4 days' time, I will be able to add a 200-year-old haunted house to that list. I do investigate, sure. I research. Quite a bit, definitely. But I am going to leave the official title of paranormal investigator to people like today's guest. My guest has been investigating and researching the paranormal for over 2 decades. He is the host of the Unseen Paranormal podcast, a popular weekly program featuring interviews with highly respected researchers, historians, authors, experiencers, and fellow investigators. He and his husband also own and operate the Night House of Hopkinsville, Kentucky, a place that has been called home by notable and affluent Hopkinsville families and figures from the past, who continue to stop by, even in the afterlife, a neutral ground used as a hospital during the Civil War, a suspected stop on the Underground Railroad, and now, for the first time in its history, has opened its doors to paranormal groups to stay for the night, connect to its past, and hopefully make contact with its spirits. Please enjoy my conversation with Eric Freeman Sims.
I had my first experience when I was around 8 years old. And I was also always a weird kid who was like at the book fair, the library. I was going and looking for the UFO, Bigfoot books, ghost books. And I grew up before the TV shows. I had graduated high school before the TV shows came out. And so I didn't know what a ghost hunter was, or I didn't even know that people got together as teams and went and investigated. And so I was about 18, and I had a friend who bought me the Beginner's Guide to Ghost Hunting. And that's when I figured out, oh, okay, these people, you know, this is a hobby that people actually do. And but when I was 14, my father passed away, and that kind of kicked me into what happens after we die. Yeah. Because I wanted to prove myself that he was agnostic, which I'm agnostic, and so I don't have a, you know, religious background there to believe in. So I wanted to prove that, you know, we go on afterwards. And so me and my friends started going out to cemeteries and places and sneaking in some places to investigate and caught evidence. And we just had an old VHS camcorder that, you know, you held on your shoulder back then. And this is the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s. And we had a voice recorder that had the little bitty mini tapes, cassette tapes. And we would catch voices and we got some video stuff. And so it just kind of, it was cool to have a group of friends that were willing to, they were in it for more of the thrill and to get scared, you know, to whereas I was trying to prove something, you know, to myself and all that. And then, and so it's just kind of snowballed from there. We used to go out. I would, especially when I started driving, we would go out a lot more on the weekends. And that's kind of what we did. We didn't cause any trouble, no vandalism, nothing like that. We did trespass, but no harm, no foul. And I think the statute of limitations is over this long. But, and then in the early 2000s, I had graduated high school and I was getting into my medical career, cause I worked in medicine for 20 years and, Ghost Hunters came out. First the show MTV's Fear came out. And that got me more interested, and I started watching Most Haunted, which is a show, a big popular show in England, and it's been proven to be fake now, but it was entertaining. And so I started watching those shows and kind of learning different techniques, take different pieces from different people in different shows and things that I liked, things I didn't like. And I've kind of always been a little bit of a lone wolf. I've never really been part of a team, but I've always investigated with other teams and with my friends, and I've always wanted to be free to do what I want and kind of thing, you know, not be tied down to one team. And there's nothing wrong with being part of a team. I just like the freedom to go around and investigate with different people and different teams without people getting jealous or whatever. And also, nowadays my schedule is so crazy that I couldn't commit to a team if I wanted to, just with the podcast and with the Nighthouse and other things I have going on. I'm on a committee to plan a big, paranormal convention for Hopkinsville for next year. So
I got nine
irons in the fire all at one time. So yeah, always doing something in the paranormal community. Now I've got conventions that I'm speaking at and things like that. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, it just kind of snowballed from there and had lots of experiences when I was younger. I grew up as an empath. So I deal especially mostly with living people's energy. I've just recently in the past 5 years started kind of being okay with delving into the dead people's energy and kind of reading that. But mm-hmm. my mom was an empath as well. And it kind of runs in my family.
Whoa.
And yeah, to the point that I would like come home from school and she would tell me something I was excited about. She knew nothing about, she would just know. And she just knew things, you know, and kind of passed that along. But I was scared of it for a long time. So I didn't embrace it, didn't talk about it. And then once I dove deep into the paranormal, started the Instinct Paranormal podcast 5 years ago, I got more and more comfortable because I'm talking to like-minded people and kind of surrounded now, you know, with a community of like-minded people that don't really judge. And so, yeah, it's kind of been my journey. The podcast definitely threw me into the paranormal world, kind of knee deep. And I just started the podcast because I wanted to talk to people that I saw on TV, people I knew in the community, mm-hmm. and it would give me an outlet to talk to them. I never intended on the podcast to get popular or be what I do for a living or anything like that, but it kind of came at the right time too, because I worked 15 years in emergency medicine, between the ambulance and between the ER. And, I was kind of getting burnt out. My body's worn out. I have back issues. I have knee issues. I have shoulder issues, and also the mental toll of PTSD and things like that. So, I retired from medicine after 20 years and I've been doing the podcast, and the podcast is, like I said, I do that, as a job. It does pay the bills. It pays its own bills. Mm-hmm. At least, you know, through ads and things like that. And then I got into doing charity stuff with them, public ghost hunts, where all that goes to charity. I put on a big expo last year in Nashville that we gave a lot of money to charity. And so just trying to do good things in the paranormal world and stay busy.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, my gosh. You got like way more pokers in the fire than you said. That was a lot. Do you sleep ever?
I'm an insomniac, so about 4 or 5 hours a night. So,
oh, no. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Nailed it. Yeah. Okay. So I have some questions about all of that. That's you sparked some inspiration here. So you have been investigating basically since you were 14, since you started going out and sneaking into places with your friends.
I'm 41 now, so whatever that math is. Yeah.
some kind of math. We won't get into it. Okay, so you said you're a lone wolf. You kind of like to do your own kind of thing, you know, and of course you don't have time to join other groups, but like what do you think it is about the way the style of your investigation that's that like sets you apart or is kind of different, or I don't know if you think people would have like issue with that or push back against that?
No, I don't think they would. Some of my friends even do that I investigate with, because I call myself a skeptical believer. I've seen plenty of things over the years for me to believe in the paranormal. And I have, I mean, even here at the Night House, just in the 5 months we've owned it, I've seen things that I can't explain. And, but I'm the first one to try to debunk anything. And that pisses some people off. Oh. Also, I'm not a big equipment guy. I don't like a lot of the equipment because it's fallible and people don't like that either. And, but also in my opinion of that equipment, I would never tell anybody what to use and nothing like that because there's no manual, there's no, but in my opinion, it's an educated one. So for like example, REM pods, you can set them off with a walkie-talkie really easily. You don't even have to talk to the walkie-talkie. You just push the key on the walkie-talkie. And if you're within 20 feet of a REM pod, it will set it off.
Oh,
so wow. Yeah. So if those type of radio waves will set it off, what's to say that a trucker who's on the interstate 5 miles away that has a really powerful CB that reaches hundreds of miles won't set it off also? And so I think a lot of that equipment is fallible in that way that you can't ever prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that's actually evidence. Mm-hmm. Now I'm not going to say that REM pods don't work. I mean, if you correlate it with like an EVP at the same time, or you have a piece of video where you see an orb going into the antenna and it goes off, I've had that happen before.
Yeah.
It's just, I think the equipment's fallible. It was never made to detect ghosts and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I think I butt heads with people a lot in that way because people get comfortable in their use of equipment and everybody likes to be in a box where they're comfortable. And if somebody comes in and tries to, not even purposely, try to, you know, change your beliefs, it's people are pushed back against that.
Yeah.
And so yeah. I'm just not a big tech guy. I like video and I like audio. And if I can disprove it in any way, then it's not evidence to me.
Yeah.
Well, and a lot of people don't like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Some people are very, very partial to their equipment or have got their favorite piece. But you know what? Being an empath as you are too, like, I think anyway, your body is my best tool for sensing and sussing it out. But being an empath, that's probably going to be quite a bit more and something that you can look to whenever you are on these investigations. Yeah. What do you think about phone apps?
There's just too much. You don't know people's intention when they program them for one. So I think there's too much room there. I don't care if you turn your phone on airplane mode. When you pulled up to the location, that app knows where you're at now. And with AI the way it is, they can build that into the app for it to pull words that are specific to that location. Because a lot of locations go to are historic and they're known. You can find information online.
Yep.
So why couldn't that app be pulling words from Google that have to do with that location? So if you're out of jail, it's going to spit out words that have to do with a jail or a prison or a hotel or, you know, a historic house. So even if you turn your phone on airplane mode later.
Yeah.
And because especially the biggest problem that I have with the paranormal community is money. When money gets involved, it just ruins things. And so with these people creating these apps, they're trying to make money, charging $10 a piece for some of them. And so their incentive is to get more people to download it. So the more evidence that people get with it, the more they're going to tell their friends, and the more their friends are going to download it and things like that. So I don't put a whole lot of stock in the apps because of that. It's the whole technology thing. And so it's a weird dichotomy for me to be an empath and feel things that I can't necessarily prove and to be the skeptical mind too.
Yeah.
In a way, it's a conflict of interest in my own brain sometimes of like struggling to, you know, did I really feel this? Did I really see what I saw? But the apps are, yeah, it just, it doesn't, and even like people want to say, well, necrophonic, you know, well, some of them may be listening to what you're saying and spitting words back out at you as well. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't know the intention. And unless you're a programmer and can dive deep into like that code and find out what is in there, you know. And I haven't seen anybody do that.
Yeah.
I've seen the apps debunked quite easily, more than they've been proven. And the ghost radar, don't even come at me with that. That's just ridiculous.
Oh, no. Yeah. For entertainment purposes only. It says it right on the app, folks. Yeah. But yeah, like I very good points. Very good points. Things I hadn't even thought about, those phone apps. I feel like it's kind of like a lot of the other equipment too. Like if it correlates with something else that you are capturing, okay, maybe. But by itself, no.
Yeah.
Well, one more question about
paranormal investigating, and then I want to circle back to something where in all of these decades that you've been doing it, what are some cool locations you've been to? Where have you hunted?
Oh, so many locations. Let's see. I've been to Brushy Mountain twice. Actually, the past year, I've been to Brushy Mountain twice. The Lodes House in Franklin, Tennessee. I've investigated the Ripley's, believe it or not, the original Ripley's, believe it or not, in St. Augustine, Florida. Mm-hmm. I've investigated outside of the fort in St. Augustine. I've been to Sorrel Weed House in Savannah. Where else? Been to Gettysburg. Last year, went to Gettysburg for the first time. That was a lot of fun. Waverly Hills. Yeah, there's a long list there.
Yeah.
And a lot of, I like the smaller locations that people never heard of. Mm-hmm. So like the Lodes House in Franklin, Tennessee, Trousdale Place in Gallatin, like even Old Stone Jail in Franklin, Kentucky. The Scott County Jail in Huntsville, Tennessee is amazing. And, there's just so many locations that haven't been on TV. So they're not hugely popular or famous or that are just as amazing.
Yeah.
Sorry, I forgot to mute my phone. That are just as amazing as the ones that you've seen, you know, on TV.
Yeah.
And so, so many locations. But I love, like I said, I love the smaller locations that haven't been overdone. Mm-hmm. Also because I love diving into the history. And I'm a huge history buff. And so that's my favorite thing. I don't want to go, don't get me wrong, Waverly Hills is amazing. Brushy Mountain is amazing. But they've been on the TV shows, and if you watch those, you know the history of these places, and for the most part. So I kind of like the mystery of the history, I guess you'd say.
Yeah. And you had quite the mystery to unravel with the Night House. And we are going to ask you about that, because I told you I wanted to geek out on the Night House. So we are saving a good portion of today's show about that, because I'm a history buff too. Love getting into the history. But you mentioned your first experience took place when you were 8 years old. Are you able to tell us that story?
Yeah. I was, it was just me and my parents that lived in the house. And they bought the house brand new in the 70s. And so there's nothing that I ever found on the land. I still live in the house. I inherited it from them. And that's where we live. I only live part-time at the Night House. But I inherited the house from them. There's nothing on the land or nothing ever happened in the house that would make it haunted. And when I was 8, I was asleep. And I always liked the door shut. That always made me feel, it's to this day, I sleep with the door shut. It just makes me feel more comfortable and safe, I guess. And so I woke up in the middle of the night out of a dead sleep, sat straight up in bed, and the door was across from my bed. So the foot of my bed was pointing toward the doorway. And there was a glowing lady in the door, like glowing white, standing in the door wide open. She's standing in the door. And I jumped up. It scared me. So I jumped up, flipped the light on, and slammed the door. And I mean, I stared at her for probably 10 seconds before I, you know, my body reacted to get up and slam the door and, you know, turn the light on, slam the door. Yeah.
And you said you've never been able to find anything about it. Did it ever happen again? Anything similar like that?
Not with her. With being an empath, what I always say about us empaths is that we're like a lighthouse in the dark, mm-hmm. To dead people. And so we're like this beacon. And so I get transient spirits if I don't keep my house kind of blocked off. I'll get transient spirits that come in. And we have a resident spirit that followed me home when I was a teenager. I'm pretty sure it's a Civil War soldier that followed me home from a location. And he's been around for a long, long time. Even my husband, when we first got together, we've been together 19 years. Mm-hmm. And when we first got together, he didn't believe any of this. And then he started seeing the empath stuff. And then he started seeing the paranormal stuff happen in the house. He's never even been on a ghost hunt with me in 19 years, you know, going on 20 years. And, but here in the, you know, he's over the years, he's gotten better because he's experienced a lot of stuff. And, mm-hmm. and some of the stuff that I tell him at our house that happens, he'll experience it. And so he has no choice but to kind of believe in all of it now. And then so with the Night House, he was on board with the Night House. And he's had quite a few experiences here himself, by himself. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, we get some transient spirits. But yeah, with the empath stuff, it's like a beacon in the dark. For spirits, and so they come and go, and some of them are nasty, and I've got to get rid of them, and I call friends for help and things to get rid of them, and most of them are good, but it's interesting, but I've never yeah, I never found any reason for the property or the house to be haunted. Like I said, my parents bought it brand new. And the only person that died in my house is my father. And he's not been around. My mom and him pop in every once in a while, and they let me know little things when they do. But I also remember my mom's perfume. She wore, which now people probably call it old lady perfume, but Jovan Musk.
And, oh, yeah. I remember that. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that's what she wore. That was her perfume. And so and we've remodeled the entire house. So there's no way for it to be like stuck in the drywall or anything. Mm-hmm. We've pretty much gutted all the drywall, and I'll just get a whiff of her perfume out of nowhere. And then my dad, he moves things around, but he'll do certain things that knows him. He doesn't come around as much as my mom. My mom pops in every once in a while. A couple of years ago, I was standing in our kitchen, and we have a big island, a big 4-foot island in the middle of our kitchen. And I was fixing me something to drink, something in the middle of the day, and my husband Roger was back doing laundry. And I felt something hit me in the back, and then I heard something hit the floor, and it was a piece of candy corn. Well, I am diabetic, so I don't eat candy. Mm-hmm. And we have eight dogs, and they're all spoiled. They're all house dogs. You know, they have their run. They go outside, but they're in the house. So there's no way that any food is going to survive on the floor in our kitchen. And so all I could think was this piece of candy corn is what hit me in the back. My mom loved candy corn, and it was right after Halloween. And so I was like, okay, Mom, I got you.
Wow. Yeah,
it's kind of the same as people like getting, I've been hearing this more and more about people finding coins with specific dates on them, or mm-hmm. coins just supporting out of nowhere and hitting the floor. And when they pick it up, it's a date that's going to, or people finding feathers and things like that. But yeah, I think she threw a piece of candy corn at me. So she was a jokester. She's a funny lady. So.
That's gotta go into a book or something. Oh, right. So I hear you are working on a book. Is that true?
I've been working on a book for like a year and a half now. I haven't had time to finish it. All the research is done, and I've got half of it written. I just need to write the other half. The Night House is going to give me time to do that. When I have teams in the house, I can sit back in my office and I can work on it. It is called Small Town Haunts and Legends in Tennessee. And so the point of it is it has your cryptids, it has your ghost stories in there, mm-hmm. and it has a whole lot of history. And so the point of it is to highlight small locations and cryptids that you've never heard of and legends that you've never heard of, unless you live in those local communities, those small towns. Mm-hmm. And so there's lots of hauntings in there, but there's a whole cryptid section. And I put plenty of like Native American legends in there as well. And things like that. But yeah, like it's Small Town Haunts and Legends of mm-hmm. Tennessee. So yeah, things that people haven't heard of. And there's some really interesting hauntings and history. And mm-hmm. it's the first bird haunting I ever heard of is in the book from a plantation in West Tennessee. One of the enslaved ladies who cooked in the kitchen, the outdoor kitchen, you know, they always had a separate kitchen. Mm-hmm. There was a separate building for the summer kitchen. She had a macaw parrot, and it stayed in the kitchen with her, and it lived with her, but it came in the kitchen with her while she cooked. And to this day, they still hear and see the macaw. They'll see it through the window.
What?
And they'll hear it. They'll hear it whistling and talking and screeching.
Oh, yeah. Whoa. See, that's the kind of stuff. Like just like you said, you know, these are the stories that people don't hear, and that's what you're going to kind of highlight. Like, As a podcaster who does their due diligence, as somebody who is so into history and like is hungry for those types of occurrences that nobody has heard of, nobody talks about that. Oh, yeah. I'm going to have you back on when that is published. I'm going to reach out because that sounds awesome. Awesome. Well, keep at it. I want to see it. Oh, let's see. So we are, gosh, the time has flown. So I do want to go ahead and get into the Night House.
Yep.
Oh, and I want you to feel free to talk at length about this because it's such an awesome place. It's new to the scene. A lot of folks are still not familiar with the name, even know that it is available right now for investigations. Investigators can book it right now, reasonable prices. And being who I am, I desperately want to just paint a picture of like the history and the people who probably we might run into here in a week's time, the people that we might come across, and just give us that that life of the Knight House. Why don't you go ahead and just start walking us through the history?
So we've owned the house for 5 months. I have definitely done a deep dive into the history. I found out things the local historian didn't know, and he's taught me a lot of things as well. But there's still a lot of things we don't know. There's a lot of history. I was just looking up this morning, because I was wide awake at 4 o'clock this morning because I sent him some yak. I was on the computer doing research about some of the earlier owners of the house and seeing what I could find about them. The Knights, we call it the Knight House because the Knight family lived here for 80 years. The mom, the dad, and all their 7 children lived here. And it was in their family until their last child died in 1939. So from 1860 to 1939, 1940, it was in there. Well, it was in their family until 1941. So that's when the grandkid who got the house, he'd actually died. He was going to move here, and he died in 1941. But the house was built between 1850 and 1820. It is the oldest standing structure in Christian County, Kentucky, and in Hopkinsville. It is in the top 15 or 20 oldest structures still standing in Kentucky. And so this house has seen some history, you know, over 200 years of history. And she is still kicking. She's still beautiful. She still has good bones. We don't know who built it. Nobody's ever found out who built it. Mm-hmm. William Turner is the historian here in town. He's been a historian for 50 years. And he's known of this house. Some of his family owned the house briefly in the 1940s. And when he was a kid, he was inside the house here. So he's been familiar with it since he was a kid. And he's been the county historian for 50 years now. And he's never been able to find who originally built the house. Mm-hmm. But back then, there wouldn't necessarily have been a deed for the property or the house.
Right.
Until the house was sold and the property was sold, then a deed was generated later on. So the first owner that we know of was actually in the 1840s. Was a guy named Ware, and he sold it to another family in 1844. And then they sold it in 1846 to the Waddell family. And the Waddell are the one who they owned it for about 12, 13 years, and they sold it to the Knight family in 1860. The Waddell family, I just found out this morning, the reason that they sold it to the Knights is they actually, in 1857, 1858, they actually picked up and moved to Texas. Ariel Waddell was actually he got elected as a member of the Kentucky State House, and he served either one or two terms, and then he's part of the Whig Party back then, and he was against the Civil War and against the government, but he was what made him kind of unpopular and he didn't get reelected was he was for the Mexicans. And so with Texas and all that being part of Mexico, and he didn't agree, from what I found out, with the Alamo and the United States taking over Texas. So he ends up moving. They end up moving him and his family end up moving to Texas, and they sold the house to the Knight family. And the Knight family, like I said, lived here for 80 years. The house originally was built in the federal style. So the brick structure that you see in the pictures was the original house. Very boxy. Mm-hmm. It's just the brick is all that was original. The very first house. But since the house has been occupied its entire history, it has been updated and changed. So the columns that you see right there in that side portico and the dining room, all that was built by J.B. Knight. I have a contract for the front porch that he added on to from a contractor, the handwritten contract where he charged them $110, including materials, to build the front porch.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, boy, yeah. What a steal.
Yeah. And the front porch, so if you look at the front of the house, there's two windows, and then there's no windows on the other side of the front door. If you look at condos nowadays, that's how they're built. And that's where they got that style from, and I forget the name of the style, but it's a certain style. And so it wouldn't have had a front porch. It would have just been a facade, a door, and just stairs going down. They would have not had a front porch like it's on the house now. Mm-hmm. And J.B. Knight added the front porch, the side porch, and the big columns. He switched the house over to Greek Revival, which a lot of people with plantation homes are familiar with. The Knight house was never a plantation. The Knight family bought the house in 300 acres, but J.B. Knight was a real estate mogul and an attorney. They only farmed and only had enough enslaved people to farm for them, their own selves. They never farmed to sell it. They never did tobacco, sugarcane, any of those plantation things. Mm-hmm. Kentucky was a neutral state during the Civil War, and Hawkinsville was taken over three times by the Confederates and three times by the Union. Somehow, the Knight family got out unscathed. They did not lose any money. They didn't lose any property through both occupations, which is weird. It's very weird. So they played both sides very well, apparently. And they did have 15 enslaved people in the 1860 census. And then after the war, one of the families stayed on as paid domestic servants and lived on the property here. And they took the last name of Moore. And it was a father. He was the farmhand, but also a sharecropper. So he farmed part of the land for him and his family to sell to make money and for themselves. And then he also worked for the Knights on their farm. And his wife and their kids were domestic servants in the house. So they did all the housework for the Knights. And they got paid for this after the Civil War when they were emancipated. During the Civil War, the house was used as a – there's lots of places that claim this. The house was used as a hospital for the Confederates, but not for wounded soldiers. There was a plague that went through the Confederate soldiers in Hawkinsville that killed 300 of them. And it was called the Black Pox pneumonia. And doctors today still don't know what caused that. They don't know what kind of virus or what it was, but it killed 300 soldiers. And there's a mass grave in Riverside Cemetery that has all those Confederate soldiers. And the Knight House basement was one of the places they used as a hospital. Back during the Civil War, Hawkinsville did not have a proper hospital. Now, they had doctors that would come to your house and treat you, but not a hospital per se. You'd have to go to Louisville or Nashville to get to a hospital. And so they brought enslaved people from other farms to come help take care of these soldiers as well. We have a secondhand account of a lady's grandmother who came to take care of those soldiers, but she was not owned by the Knights. She came from different farms, borrowed, and she told her granddaughter how she came here to take care of those Confederate soldiers, or her granddaughter ended up becoming the domestic paid servant for the Rogers family in the 50s and 60s. And she lived in the summer kitchen. They turned that into an apartment for her with a bathroom. And her grandmother, it's crazy that, you know, she was connected to this house by her grandmother coming here to take care of Confederate soldiers. The Knight family were extremely filthy wealthy. Back in the 1850s, 1860s, from what we found, with not just money, but all their land and real estate, they were worth about $10 million.
Wow.
Mm. Well, if you for inflation, if you multiply that by either 36 or 40, they were very
millionaires. Yeah.
Yeah. You're talking about almost half a, you know, quarter billion to half a billion dollars. Insane amount of money. And J.B. Knight, he was a very well-known attorney around here. And like I said, he was more of a real estate mogul. The historian, I have not had a chance to go to the courthouse and look up all of the real estate stuff that J.B. did. But the historian told me that he spent 2 days in a row there one time and went through thousands of real estate documents that J.B. Knight had a part of. Wow. So, yeah. Him and his wife, Eliza, had 7 kids. All of their kids reached adulthood. They did not have any kids that I found that died as infants or anything like that, which is, it's unusual for them to have 7 kids back then with cholera, tuberculosis, and all that. Because you had big cholera epidemics all around this area down in the Tennessee that killed off a lot of people. Yellow fever epidemics as well. And the Trail of Tears actually comes right through Hawkinsville. Which would have brought a lot of disease too through here. But all their kids lived to adulthood. So Eliza, her family is from Hawkinsville in this area. She came from a very prominent family. Her maiden name was Brian. And her sister married another prominent citizen here. And they built a house called Lone Oak, which is still standing here in Hawkinsville right down the street. It was built in 1835. And it stayed in the Crockett family for many, many years. And then her brother, Thomas Bryan, built a house on 17th and Main. And the reason I mentioned that house is because it's no longer there. It burned down in 2014. They tore it down. But Thomas died, and the Knight's youngest son, who was named after his uncle, Thomas Sharp Knight, was named after his uncle, Thomas Bryan. He moved into that house when he got married, and this is how much money they had. He didn't like that it faced Main Street, so he paid to have the house picked up and turned to face 17.
That'd be nice. That'd be nice to just switch my house around. Yeah, feng shui.
Yeah. So they had three daughters and four sons. Mm-hmm. All but one of their sons. So three of their sons became attorneys, just like their father. Their other son was a big farmer. He moved out of Hopkinsville and became a big farmer, more towards the east, Henderson, and not that way in Kentucky. And his name was Robert. The second oldest son and second oldest kid, John, they called him John Jr., but he wasn't a junior. He didn't have the same middle name as his dad. Mm-hmm. But they called him John Jr. He became an attorney. And in 1871, the Great Chicago Fire happened in Chicago, where we all heard Destiny Cow kick over the liner and that whole folklore. Well, J.B. Knight owned a three-story apartment building in Chicago, and it burned down. So he sent John Jr. up there to stay with their cousins, the Marshalls. They had cousins up in Chicago, and oversee the rebuilding of this property because it made him a lot of money. And he never came back to Hopkinsville except to visit. John Jr., he started a law firm with his cousin Marshall, last name Marshall. I forget his first name. They started their own law firm and became huge real estate magnates in Chicago. And he was a socialite, and he was a bachelor until he was 40 and got married and had a stepson, and then they had two daughters. And his wife died pretty early on. They were only married 5 or 6 years before his wife died. And then he took care of her son, which was his stepson, and the two daughters. And he lived until 1929. And he's the only member of the family we actually have pictures of, modern day photographs, because he was in Chicago, which was a modern town. So photography became a big thing in the 1900s. And so he had a big photograph of himself that hung in his law firm. But he did more real estate than he did as an attorney as well. And when I looked him up on newspapers.com for Chicago, there was 83 pages of basically advertisements for him and his law firm advertising real estate. So whether they were renting it out or whatever, but he owned quite a few buildings that he was the landlord of as well. And he lived in one of his own buildings with his kids. And so he was really successful. Two of their daughters died at a young age. Kate died when she was 22, 23 of tuberculosis. She never had kids. She never got married. And she lived in this house the majority of her life. The other daughter that died from tuberculosis as well, she died actually before Kate died. Carrie, she was 25. Carrie has an interesting story. She had three kids before she died, though, so she actually had kids. Carrie married a guy named John Harding. Well, John Harding went to school with Charlie, one of the other kids, at Bethel College in West Virginia. John Harding went to be a preacher. He went to school to be a preacher. Charlie went to be an attorney. Like I said, all the boys except for one became attorney. Well, they became best friends when they went to college together, and they're both from this area. So when they came back from college, John Harding moved into the Knight house here with the Knight family. Well, I guess him and Carrie sparked up a romance, which they were both 18, 19, 20 at this time, you know, mm-hmm. somewhere in their early 20s. Sparked up a romance. They ended up getting married, and they had three kids. And then she died at the age of 25. John Harding ends up taking the kids and moving to Nashville. And the reason he moved to Nashville is because his friend asked him to help found Lipscomb College in Nashville, which is still around. David Lipscomb College is still around today.
Wow.
And his family, the Hardings, did a lot of stuff in Nashville. So we have Harding Pike. We have a bunch of different things, schools and stuff named after the Hardings. Mm-hmm. And he ended up getting remarried and having other kids on top of the three that he already had with Carrie. And so then you had Ida. Ida was the other daughter, and she was the youngest kid. She lived in this house until 1938. when she died. She was a lifelong maiden. So she never got married, never had kids. She lived in the house pretty much her entire life. Mm-hmm. Every census that I've seen, she's on every one of them living here. And it just says that she's a homemaker. So she never had, you know, of course, women back then didn't really have jobs anyway. But she was always here. So she passed away. She was a character, though. So there are stories from the 1920s and 30s that she used to ride in the early 1900s. Even though they sold off bits and pieces of land over the years, they still had a pretty good chunk of land here. Mm-hmm. And it was fenced in. And because they still had cattle and pigs and things. And she would ride in full, like, Victorian gown, you know, lace choker, big dress. Side saddle on a horse with a shotgun, and she would patrol their property, keep trespassers off of it. Yeah.
This is Ida.
Yeah.
Like her. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then also I found some ads in newspapers where she was selling eggs, and not just eggs to eat. She sold eggs to eat, but she also sold these, I forget what they call them. It's a special kind of duck that she was selling. Oh. And special kind of turkey eggs that people could buy from her for like $3 a piece and hatch and have their own special turkeys and raise them or whatever, and ducks. And so there's all these ads in the newspaper, contact Ida Knight if you want these eggs. You know, of course, they didn't have phone number or anything. You just had to know where she lived. You know, they didn't even put the address in there. You know, you just had to know where she lived. But most people around town knew who the Knights were and knew where they lived because they were such a prominent family. When J.B. Knight died in 1880, and his son, their oldest son, Robert, actually died right before his dad did in 1880. And Eliza, she lived until 1886. And they're pretty old. I mean, they were both in their late 70s when they died. So they lived a long, I mean, for that day and time, they lived long lives. And at the time that he died, J.B. was the oldest member of the Hobsonville Bar Association. For attorneys. And he had been practicing law for that many years. Since the Knight House is only about half a mile from downtown, he never had an office in town. His office was actually out here by the road in front of the house. He had a separate building down there that was his law office. And the road that goes in front of the Knight House here, 7th Street, is actually the Russellville Highway and has been here since the early 1800s. And this was the main road to get in and out of Hawkinsville if you wanted to go east towards Russellville and Bowling Green and Louisville. Mm-hmm. And it was the main thoroughfare anyway because you had to go east to connect with the Louisville-Nashville Highway Road. It was a wagon trail that either went north to Louisville or south of Nashville. Mm-hmm. And so this was very well traveled in front of the house here. And so he would have got a lot of traffic. In the late 1800s, I'm trying to think of the date. I think 1890s or the early 1900s, Ida was doing her rounds, and she found a dead body out by the road on the other side of the fence. Yeah, and the guy had had a heart attack and fallen off his horse and broke his neck. And I have the newspaper article. Wow. In the newspaper article, it says that he was found in front of Charles Knight's house, but I found another article saying that Ida had found it. Also, Ida found a murder victim down by the road one time, too, where he was shot and his body was just dumped in front of the Knight house.
Oh, my gosh. So these two just bodies that didn't need to be there, they were found on the property.
Now, I think the guy who fell off his horse, I think he lived. He was still alive when they found him.
Okay, okay.
And they took him into town, and he died in town.
Oh, okay.
I actually just found that one this morning. That was a newspaper article I found this morning. The Knight family, they're a very interesting family. They're very eccentric, and they're pretty private people. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, they didn't do a whole lot of entertaining, but they were very well known in the community and very well respected.
Yeah.
And spend a lot of money in the community too, you know, with buying and selling property and paying taxes and things like that. So, and they also, of course, you know, they have one of the nicest houses in town. So, you know, they paid lots of money for carpenters to come build the front porch, to build the side porch, to, you know, put these fancy doorknobs on that cost an arm and a leg back then. And so, you know, they would have been a good boost and help to the local economy and local craftsmen and things.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they needed farriers and things like that because they had mules and they had horses. And so they would have paid for farrier services. And I actually have two books of handwritten letters and notes and things like that. There's a couple hundred in there that is all the business dealings, a lot of the business dealings of the Knight family. And all of them pertain to the Knight family. The earliest one in there is from 1833, and the latest one is from the 1880s. So they span a good 50 years of letters and notes and envelopes. I have an original J.B. Knight business card, and I find this funny because it just says J.B. Knight, attorney at law. They didn't have any phone numbers or anything.
Contact info.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, no address, no nothing. But in the letters, there's some personal letters in there. You kind of get the sense of, excuse me. There's some personal letters in there. A cousin of the Knight children, her name was Hortense, and she would write to Kate and to Ida when they were teenagers. And it's just funny to see them gossiping about things and poking fun at each other for things. There's a couple of those letters in there. And then like J.B. Knight's father, R.B. Knight, J.B. became rich because of his father. Mm-hmm. J.B. was a middle child of 14 kids.
Whoa.
And when his father died in 1843, it's really when he got his inheritance and wealth. For whatever reason, his father made him the executor of his will. So he was the main executor. So he inherited the majority of stuff. And so I have a lot of letters in there. I actually have his father's handwritten will from 1840, from the three-page handwritten will. And divvying up all of his stuff to his different children and stuff.
Yeah.
There's a lot of dealings in one of the books with the majority of the book is dealing with his estate. So having it in probate and paying off debts. J.B. was paying off debts and things that his father had. But his father was loaded as well. His father owned thousands of acres between Iowa, Illinois, Kentucky, Georgia. Yeah, and so that got divvied between J.B., his brother Aaron, and his brother Alicia. Those three got the majority of the estate from what I see in the letters. And those three were the executors as well. So they divvied out their father's estate. Their mother died not too long after the father, and they lived to ripe old age too. And I couldn't find where they had any of their kids die. All 14 of their kids lived adulthood as well.
Okay.
Including JB as one of the middle children.
Okay. These letters and like these documents were these found in the house or on the property?
They were not. As far as I know, they've been handed down from owner to owner.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Since JB had his legal office down by the road here, we think that's why they survived, because he probably had a paralegal, which is probably his wife. Probably Eliza, who kept very good records for taxes and all that stuff. And that's where these probably came from. When the Knights sold the property, that building, his original office, from what I understand, in the 1940s, when the Major family bought it and renovated the house before they sold it to the Rogers family. So the Major family only owned the house for like 6-7 years. But J.B. Knight's office was moved to the back of the property. And I think the Majors are probably the ones that understood the importance of keeping documents like that. I don't have any confirmation on that. That's just my educated guess. Like I said, we're still unraveling things about the house. I know a lot about the house and the families, but still unraveling things about it. Charles Knight, we'll get to Charles, and then we'll get to Thomas, and then we'll move on to the Rogers family. But Charles became an attorney, but Charles really didn't practice law. About 2 miles down the road, we have the Western Kentucky Hospital, is what they call it now. Back when it was built in 1848, up until probably 30 years ago, they called it the Western Kentucky Lunatic Asylum. And they house the criminally insane. You can go there for drug treatment. They do, you know, any mental health stuff. They're the Western State Hospital for mental health. To this day, it is a massive place. At one time, I think it sat on 600 acres, and they had like 80-some buildings. They also had a poor farm and all that. It is still in operation to this day. They still have the criminally insane there. They still treat patients, and it's a massive, massive place. But Kentucky only has, I believe, two state mental hospitals. You have Western State, and you have Eastern State. Zonely, and so they have to have these big giant hospitals. Anyway, in 1883, Charles Knight became the president of the board of commissioners for the hospital. And so from 1883 until 1921, he ran the hospital. He was the boss. There were doctors and stuff under him that kind of ran the hospital, like day-to-day operations. But as far as like the finances and all that stuff, he ran it. Until 1921, when there was this big scandal in the paper, because there was a new governor came into office who did not like Charlie, and Charlie did not like him. And so the governor got the commissioners to rally behind him and to oust Charles as the president.
Okay.
Charles was old by then, and he died in 1924 here at the house. Ida and Thomas were still alive at that time. Thomas being the very youngest. Thomas's wife passed away in the 1920s, and he moved back into the house and lived here until he died in 1939. Like I said, Ida died in 1938. Thomas was a very accomplished attorney in town. He actually did practice law. He was still well-to-do on his own without his family's money. When he died, one of Carrie's children that she had with John Harding, Leon Knight Harding, he inherited the house as the oldest grandchild. If you notice, most of the Knight kids did not have kids.
Yeah, yeah.
The only one that had children, there were two of them that had children. Robert, the oldest, had like seven kids, and then Carrie had three kids. So Leon Knight Harding was the oldest. He inherited the house, and he planned on moving here to Hopkinsville from, he lived in Middle Tennessee somewhere. Well, he died in 1941. When he died, nobody else wanted the house, and the house sat vacant for a couple of years. So there was a ginormous auction that people came from hundreds of miles around because the reputation of the Knights having nice furniture and, you know, being opulent. And every piece of furniture that the Knights owned was sold.
Man.
So you will not find any original furniture in the house.
Oh.
To the Knights, to the Knight family. Mm-hmm. To the Rogers family, we have a lot of furniture from that even dates back to the 1920s and 30s that had been in their family. When they moved in here, they brought it. We have a 1938 piano, upright piano, a Baldwin Akersonic piano that was the Rogers family. We have a bed from the 1800s, late 1800s, a canopy bed that belonged to the Rogers that they brought here. Mm-hmm. So like I said, so in 1941, that's when the Major family bought the house. They did massive renovations. So they added modern bathrooms. They added a modern kitchen, fixed up the house a lot. Because the Knight children, they were old. Like even Thomas being the youngest, he died in his 70s, you know, so, and Ida was pushing 80. So, you know, they didn't renovate the house too much. So this is how the house looks today. All the furniture I went and bought either Goodwill or Facebook Marketplace. Mm-hmm. I don't want the house to be a museum, especially with investigators, people doing history tours. I don't want it necessarily to be a museum. I want it to look the part, but I want people to be able to sit on the couch and take pictures. And, you know, when teams come in, they can sit on the couch, not sit on the floor. They can sit on the chairs. So that is the foyer coming in on the ground level where the big columns are.
Mm-hmm.
The parlor, the previous picture, the parlor is actually upstairs. You have to come up the stairs. So to the right of this picture is the front door, which is a smaller porch on the front. So you have to come upstairs to the second level. From outside, the windows that you see on the ground are actually the basement. That's the basement window.
Oh.
Yeah. The house is six levels. This is the ground floor.
Okay.
And then you have you go downstairs to a basement, a half basement. Mm-hmm. Then you go down another set of stairs to a cellar that is 10 foot underground that stays a constant about 68 year round. A root cellar where they would have stored food and canned goods, you know, canned food and stuff.
And that lower level that you discovered that after you bought the house, correct?
Yeah, that's a funny story. So we only looked at the house one time. We didn't go through turning lights on and stuff. It was the middle of the day. And when we went down in the basement, we looked down in the cellar and we saw you had the furnace, you had the modern furnace, and you had the modern water heater. And it was dark down there, but you could see those from the light shining from the basement, you know, from the windows. And so we're like, oh, cool, you know. And the realtor said, you know, there's a cellar down there. She didn't say how big it was or anything. We thought it was just the extent that you could see right there. So we ended up buying the house. And the first day when we got the keys, we come over here, and the owner we bought it from had been here collecting his stuff, and they hadn't lived here in 2 years, so they didn't have a lot of stuff. But he was collecting some stuff, and he had the lights on down there, and we figured out there's this huge cellar. Like, it, when you go past the furniture stuff, it's a hallway, and then it opens up to, like, a 10 by 10 room, and there's a coal chute from the 1900s that actually has, like, a manhole, metal manhole cover that actually is covered up by the sidewalk that comes up to the columns. But it was the coal chute. They would open the manhole cover and dump the coal down there, and you would have had, you know, coal for your furnace. So yeah, we didn't know it was that big until we actually bought the house, and then it's surprisingly huge root cellar. The weird thing is too, and nobody knows why. I've talked to three different historians that don't have a clue. Out under one of the sheds out here, there's another cellar, stacked stone, that's 5 foot deep, and they don't know what that was for.
It's just a cellar, like just a space.
Yeah, and it has a. I've been cleaning it out here lately, and there's a bunch of like mud has washed down there. So there's a bunch of dirt on the floor. But when I dug down in three separate places, it has a rock. It has a stone floor as well. But the stacked stone looks just like the stacked stone for the foundation for the house. So it looks like it would have been built similar time period, but we don't know what it's used for.
Wow. Speaking of like cool features of the house, when did you discover that you had a death door, and describe what that is? Yeah.
So I'm sitting in the dining room right now, and to my left here, there's a door that goes out to the porch with the big columns. Well, the doors you come into the foyer, it's a double set of doors, like French doors that open. Well, the week after we bought the house, we went and introduced ourselves to the town historian to the county. He's the county historian for Christian County, Kentucky. Their office is downtown, and they're open certain hours. And so me and my husband went in there to introduce ourselves and say, our intentions to open the house up to the public, because the house has never been open to the public for history, paranormal, nothing. So we went to the Historical Society and met Mr. Turner, who is, like I said, he's been the county historian for 50 years. He's 76 now. And introduced ourselves. And that was one of the questions I had for him. That was one of the questions we had, was why is there a door here when you have this big fancy entrance, this double doors? It's two sets of double doors to get into the house. And he told us the story of the death door. And after that, I've learned that there's actually two beliefs about a death door, depending on what you believed. And the death door was a Victorian thing. So it was started in the 1860s, 1870s, whenever spiritualism started. So it was put in by the Knight family at some point in time. The first belief is that the door stays. So let me explain why it's in the dining room to begin with. You have to go upstairs to the parlor. And the staircase right here, you're not getting a coffin up there. And nobody wants to carry a coffin up and down the front steps. So they would have all the wakes, pretty much probably put the coffin on the dining room table. And they would have all the wakes in here in the dining room.
Yeah, okay.
So that's why the death door is here. The two beliefs about the death door, it would stay open the entire time they're having a wake, and it was for the dead to leave the house. The living were not allowed to go through the death door until they carried the body out of the house. And it was for the make sure the spirit left the house. It was open, it stayed open 24/7 during a wake. The other belief is that the living could not enter the death door, but they would leave through the death door so the dead couldn't follow them. Okay. And it was still left open for the dead to leave the house as well. So,
kind of like we have it. Kind of like leaving, because I've heard of the idea of like when you have a death in the family and you have a wake, like you open up all the windows.
Like, yeah.
Have you heard that before? Yeah. Kind of the same. Yeah. Huh. Interesting. Yeah. It's not. It sounds spookier than it is. Death door.
Yeah,
but it's kind of cool.
I've been to many historical locations. Like I said, I'm a huge history buff. So when we go on vacation, that's what we do. Is we go to different, you know, museums and houses and things. I had never seen one before. Never heard of it until we bought this house. From what I'm told, the style of this house, for one, is very like Louisiana, more Southern type style. The death door is like that Victorian stuff, which was more New England than it ever was the South. So it was something that they got from New England. But the Knights traveled all over. I mean, J.B. Knight did business in Philadelphia, New Orleans, Chicago. I mean, you know, I have envelopes that have these stamps on there And then also like where he would get letters on or notes from like the hotel staff, like forward to JB Knight, who's in room whatever. Mm-hmm. So he traveled all around doing business because, like I said, they own property all over the country. So they very well could have, during the spiritualist movement, you know, saw the death door thing or, you know, and decided to put one in.
Wow. Oh, man. Yeah. And also, I don't remember where I heard it or read it. Something about, is there a suspicion that there's like a tunnel underneath the property?
Yeah. Yeah. So we've heard rumors of two different tunnels, one on each side of the house. So one of the tunnels, we were told that it goes from the summer kitchen to the cellar that I'm talking about that's under the shed outside. The summer kitchen, so what a summer kitchen is, the summer kitchens were always detached from the house, a separate building, and they would cook in those in the summer because they didn't want to heat up the house with the fire because they didn't have air conditioning. Mm-hmm. And in the summer, we typically have drier weather and you have more fires. So if the summer kitchen burned down, it didn't burn the whole house down. Yeah. And it was easier and cheaper to rebuild the kitchen as a single building than to, you know, rebuild the house. So it was separate from the building. And so that was the white people would have never stepped foot in the summer kitchen. It was the enslaved people that worked in there. In the wintertime, we have a giant hearth in the basement that they would have cooked on because it helped heat the house. And so they have this big, massive hearth that made a massive fire. And it'll be more like you see in the movies where they would take the big black cauldron and put it in, you know, to the fire. Outside of the summer kitchen, they would have had a beam set up coming off the building. And then they would have a beam coming down to the ground. And they would have had a big pot that hung out there too with a fire under it. And that's where they would have tanned hides and things to make leather. So they would have boiled the hides in this big vat. And they would have done that outside because it stank and they didn't want it in with the food cooking. But they don't know if the tunnel from the summer kitchen to that cellar, if that was for the enslaved people to go out there and get food out of that cellar, mm-hmm. and use the tunnel when you know, hot, cold, whatever. We don't know why. Okay. But the rumor is there's a tunnel. On the other side of the house, there's a tunnel that supposedly goes from the basement and comes out in the woods across the street.
Huh.
The only reason for a tunnel like that would be the Underground Railroad.
Right, right.
There is evidence. We've not found any really evidence to support the one that is supposed to be on this side of the house, mm-hmm. between the summer kitchen and the cellar. But there are two ginormous sinkholes that are in a line down in our yard and into the neighbor's yard, mm-hmm. that would be in line with the tunnel if it was running where they say it does.
Whoa. What would be the process, yeah. to actually confirm that's what it is?
So we have a friend, Billy Wilkerson, who we're going to have come out. His team is Whiskey Tango Foxtrot Paranormal out of Franklin County, Kentucky, Simms County, Kentucky, and Franklin, Kentucky. And he works for the museum, the Simms County Historical Society Museum, and he runs the Old Stone Jail. And his paranormal team runs the jail for investigations. Anyway, for the Historical Society, he does ground penetrating radar. And so for a donation to their Historical Society, we're hoping to get him out here to use the ground penetrating radar. And it'll tell us if there's a tunnel or not, because the ground disturbance, if it's caved in, if it's not caved in, if there's a void anywhere.
Very cool. That's exciting. That would be a really exciting, yeah. find. And just to know, like, this property, I mean, it's 200 years old. It has definitely, yeah. seen a lot of things. But that was just incredible. Thank you for humoring, yeah. me and just giving us all of that. It's just, I don't know if anybody else is going to find like the history like that as juicy as I do. I love history because history, I feel, goes hand in hand with hauntings. It tells the, yeah. story, and you've got to know it. I feel like you have to know that. And it just makes the current day occurrences that much more, spectacular and special.
Yeah.
And you've got somewhere to start from. So right now I would like to get into what is happening in the current day. What have you actually experienced as far as activity? And then who do you think is still hanging around?
So one of the interesting things with the house is I've found with even the history, a lot of synchronicity. We didn't even get into talking about the Rogers family, who lived here from the late 40s until 2014. they're an interesting family too. The grandfather was, he became Speaker of the House of Kentucky. One of the sons, the synchronicities I'm talking about is the Knights were all attorneys. Well, one of the Rogers dad and one of the sons were attorneys as well. And so that was just it's a weird synchronicity that the majority of people who have lived in this house practice law.
Yeah.
So you start with synchronicities like that. And then from day one, we've had experiences. So the day that we bought the house, we signed the paperwork. We came over here to show my husband's parents and his aunt. And I went to use the bathroom here on the first floor. It's just the room over from the dining room here. And I heard a single knock on the door. And I said, I'll be out in a minute, you know. And I came out, and there's no one out here. And they're on the other side of the house. And there's no way that one of them knocked and made it to the other side of the house before I came out. And so that was the first thing that happened. And then my husband, Roger, there's a door right here that goes from the dining room into what's going to be the modern kitchen that we've been working on. And at first, before we had that wing secured, we would lock this door. One day he was locking up and he locked this door, latched it. He heard three knocks on it and he thought he locked one of us in there. Well, he opens the door. There's nobody there, but he looks out the window and he can see me, my brother, and my brother's girlfriend sitting on the front lawn. And there's nobody else here. So he's like, okay, shut the door without locking it up. We've caught stuff on video. I wish that I would have had time to get you the video, but people can go online. It's on YouTube, the Knight House YouTube, and also the Knight House website and the Facebook page. Just look up the Knight House KY, and you'll find all that stuff on Google. But we had the white mist upstairs in the guest suite.
Yeah, it was weird.
That's the craziest thing that's happened.
Yeah.
That was about a month after we bought the house. And I can't explain it. There's no humidifier. There's nothing up there to make a mist at all. There's nothing in the house to do that.
Yeah.
We have a dehumidifier in the basement, but it doesn't pump out any kind of mist. I mean, it's sucking the moisture out of the air. It's not putting any moisture in there.
Yeah.
So that was very weird. We caught on the cameras. I have four cameras in the house and four outside. And the inside cameras, they catch noises all the time. They sound like furniture moving. And I've got a couple of those videos up to where you don't even need headphones. I mean, it's really loud. And then a couple of weeks ago, we started playing this game with one of the spirits. They wanted to close the doors. There's two French doors that go into the parlor at the top of the steps on the landing. So come in one day. Yes, the door's to the left there.
Okay.
Come in one day, and the door that shut on that picture is the door that kept shutting itself. Well, we were trying to debunk it, and the camera at the time was not on this side of the room. It was on the mantle on the other side of the room. And so I didn't have it focus on the doors, so I could never catch the door closing. Well, I had it focus on the chairs on the right because the chairs moved by themselves as well. And I need to go through and check them today. I haven't been up in the parlor today. But so the door kept closing.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, all right, I'm going to move the damn camera. Y'all think you're funny. Because you're doing it right off the frame, you know, where you can't see. I said, if you think you're funny, I'm going to move the camera where it gets the whole room. So if you move a chair or a door, I'm going to catch it. So the next night, after I moved the camera, the other door closed. And it took it 2 hours. It slowly closed over 2 hours.
Huh.
And there's no vibration. There's no reason for it to close.
Yeah.
We've tried to get it to close on its own, and it won't.
Is it only closing at night, like a certain time of night?
No, they close no different times between the two of them. And the one on the right is only closed once, but I caught it on camera, and it took it 2 hours, and it was between 1:30 and 3:30 in the morning when nobody was here.
Okay.
But the video I got up, I time lapsed it, and actually I have a video of myself explaining all of this, and then I go into the time lapse where I shrunk the video down from 2 hours and 30 seconds. So you can actually see the door close. The weird thing is like it inches back and it inches forward. Inches back, inches forward, inches back. The whole video. So if it was just straight up closed, I'd be a little more skeptical and say, well, there's something natural, mm-hmm. you know, that caused that. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you can see it go back forward, go back forward, go back forward as it closes.
Yeah.
So what force would push it back a little bit and then push it forward a little bit?
Right, right. Yeah. I, that would only be like
a breeze, right? Like yeah. some kind of, but you would have to have two sources of the right. breeze, and right. it's just not, it does not fit. And then, of course, you've got the other activity in this room. You said the chairs move.
Yeah.
Very active spot. I think I want to look at this first.
Yeah. It's a huge room too. And the camera is on top of the piano now. Mm-hmm. And I can't prove this, but I had somebody a few months ago message me and ask me if I'd heard the piano play by itself. And it's somebody who's been in the house before. I said, no, I've never heard it and haven't caught it yet, but I have cameras. Well, a couple of days after I moved that camera over, I caught it on audio and it set off the camera because the camera set up for motion and sound. It sounds like a piano key, but I can't prove that's a piano key. So I haven't put the video up. Another thing, earlier I was laughing to myself when I was talking about the ghost parrot, mm-hmm. because I had somebody message me who's familiar with the Night House, had been in here when they were kids, we're friends with the Rogers family, and said, have you heard the parrot yet? No, I didn't know that anybody ever had a parrot. Well, apparently the Rogers family had a parrot. So then I catch this audio, and I completely forgot about it. I forgot about the whole parrot thing. So then in the master bedroom, down here on the ground floor, on the camera, it sounds like somebody moving around, and then you hear a parrot whistle and squawk. And it is not any bird that lives around here in Kentucky or Tennessee. This is a parrot. I believe the Rogers family owned a macaw, and they lived like 80 or 90 years. So that's interesting. I haven't put that out because I can't prove it's a parrot. But I had to call my friend Austin. I sent him the audio and the video, and I called him, and he's the one that was like, wait a minute. Didn't you tell me somebody asked you about a ghost parrot? I was like, man, you're right. I completely forgot about that. Because it was just a comment that somebody sent me, yeah. and it was just a simple no, you know. So that's interesting. We catch sounds all the time, like furniture moving. We hear them in the house too. We heard a full disembodied voice one day. It was actually Memorial Day. It was just me and my husband here. We were putting together a canopy bed in the master bedroom, and from upstairs in the parlor, we heard a woman say a full sentence, five or six words, and it echoed through the house. But we couldn't make out what she was saying. Yesterday, I was here by myself. Things happen almost on a daily basis that we're here. Yesterday, I was here by myself working on some cameras and stuff, and I heard somebody whistle. And I thought it was outside. It sounded like a man whistle. I thought it was at somebody outside. So I went outside. The neighbors are at work. I went out front. There's nobody walking. We have people walking down the road all the time. There's nobody in sight walking down the road. You can see pretty far in both directions. The other neighbor over here is not outside, and there's nobody around the house. And this was a human whistle. This was a human man whistling.
Yeah.
So I heard that yesterday. I saw who I believe is Eliza Knight standing on the landing. I was coming through, turning the lights off and walking up one evening. And I turned and briefly saw her standing on the landing. And she's a white lady, frumpy looking white lady with a bun in her hair. And she had on a white blouse with the lace like the
collar.
Yeah. Like a choker collar. Mm-hmm. And then her sleeve, she had her hands on the banister of the stairs, the rail, and she had the fringe around the sleeves. And then below, she had like this big dress that the blouse was tucked into.
Yeah, yeah. What was that experience? Was it just like you briefly caught her, and when you looked, she was gone, or like did it last a certain period of time?
I looked at her for probably 2-3 seconds at most.
Okay.
And she was as solid as me and you.
Wow.
And she just poof gone. Like not faded away, nothing, just poof gone in the blink of an eye.
Man. Oh gosh. All right. So Eliza, potential. What do you think about who, I mean, you must have thought about like, okay, who's here? Who is this? Who are we interacting with? Who's there? Is it all intelligent? Do you think there's some residual going into this?
Yeah, I think there is residual. I think a lot of the noises are probably residual. I think that as far as the majority of the Knight family, I think they pop in. They're not here all the time. Mm-hmm. I think because they're curious what we're doing. But also, I feel like they are ready to share their story with people. So I think they'll pop in when people are investigating because they're curious what you're doing, for one. And two, they want to make sure their house is been taken care of. But also, they want to talk.
Yeah. You know?
I think there are two spirits that are here all the time. And I don't necessarily believe in spirits being stuck, but I think they're here all the time. I think the domestic servant from the 50s and 60s that worked for the Rogers, I think she's still here. They called her Georgie, and her name was Georgiana or Georgiana. And she's still here. She's still the boss. She still runs the household. Very nice, very sweet. She hasn't done anything crazy. But I think she's the one that knocks on the doors and stuff and lets you know, hey, I'm here. Like, here, get out of my way. You're in my way. I'm busy, you know, type stuff. The other one is, I don't want to put the name out there because the family is still, some of the family is still living.
Understood.
But it's somebody who, lives here.
Okay.
Recently, within the last 20 years. So that's just my belief of what I've seen. And we can talk about that off the air. I just don't want to put that name. I don't want to put the name out there when, like I said, they still have living people. I want to be respectful.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, of course. Yeah. Of course.
But yeah. And then as far as residual, like I said, I think the noise, I think some of the noises are residual. I think some of the noises are intelligent too. There's some residual conversation that my father-in-law has been down in the basement. So there's a tunnel in the, there is a tunnel in the cellar that goes under the foyer and under the dining room here and comes out under the modern kitchen and opens up to 4 feet tall and, I don't know, 12 feet wide. And he was down there doing plumbing in the tunnel, and he heard a man and a woman have a conversation in the basement. And it wasn't any of it. We were all outside. And so Roger's parents don't do the paranormal either, but they've had too many experiences. There's something else. I believe this is also residual on the property because I've seen it twice the exact same way. And my mother-in-law saw it and described it the exact same way I saw it. Me and her were standing out front, and I was standing out front when it happened to me. Pretty much the same story. I'm going to tell you the one with me and her standing out there. The front steps, the front porch has four columns in the front that support it, and it's attached to the house. Well, you have a basement window under it. So you can walk under the front porch and out the other side to the side yard. Well, we were standing on this side of it, and all of a sudden she stops mid-conversation. She walks around the porch and the stairs, and I'm like, Robin, what are you doing? And she came back around, she said, I just saw somebody in a white shirt walk on that side of the house. And she saw them through the opening under the porch. That's the exact same, I'm getting goosebumps talking about it, because that's the exact same thing I saw twice before she experienced it. And she described it the same way, walking in the same path from left to right. And when you walk around there's nobody there. But it's like a white, like, shirt a man would have worn in, like, the 1800s. You know, blousy, linen, you know. But the man just walks. And
what time of day does that take place?
This happens in the afternoon, like, full daylight, like, 2, 3 o'clock.
Okay.
I believe it was around 2 or 3 o'clock when it happened to her. We were sitting out there talking in the yard. Yeah. And it's not the neighbor next door. The neighbor next door, we know him. And our neighbors on that side, he's even further than the neighbor on this side. I mean, his house is probably 50 yards, you know, from ours. And so he would have to be off of, she would have saw him. You know what I'm saying? If she would have walked around and it would have been our neighbor, he would have had to have been close enough to our house, you know, for us to see him through that gap.
Okay.
So, yeah. Wow. Yeah. I try to play all the scenarios. But also, if that neighbor, if he comes over here, he's looking for us, and he wouldn't be walking around the back of our house.
Yeah.
He would have heard us in the front yard and walked around the stairs, you know. Mm-hmm. Or at least, saw us through the stairs and come. You know.
Well, and then just like kind of disappeared so quickly.
It's good,
especially as the owner and, of course, as an investigator and somebody who's offering this to investigators as a location to have that skeptical eye and to, you don't put stuff out until you're like, oh, okay, like I don't know what this is actually, you know, like just to have that level of, I don't know, genuine authenticity. It's very much appreciated, especially in this field. I do have just one more thing here before we get to our final segment. I wanted to know, because myself and the rest of the co-hosts of Beer, Booze, and Boogeymen are going to be descending, ascending, coalescing upon the location here in just a few days. as investigators coming into this location, do you have any advice for us specifically for the evening?
Because this is how I investigate. This is one of those mottos I'll tell you about before we start recording. And this is how I wish everybody would come in and investigate. And not saying you don't. I'm just saying this is how I hope everybody comes in here. Mm-hmm. Even here in the history and the haunting of things that have happened to me, we go in to investigate stories of a haunting, not a haunting. So when people come in here, whether they've heard my stories, what happened to me or not, I don't want you to investigate my story. They're a leading point of people that you may contact and names and, you know, the histories and names and stuff. But I want people to come in and do a fresh investigation on their own and see what they find. Mm-hmm. I don't want people to be, I want it to be objective, not subjective, because they're trying to validate what I experienced.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, with y'all coming in here, I want you to have your own investigation and do things how you do them and not let my stories of what happened to me affect how y'all investigate and lead you in a direction or anything like that. Like, I want you to come in fresh and say, okay, well, these are some names and this is what Eric thinks is here. But you might find somebody else is here. Because like I said, I think there's some of them that pop in and pop out. I also think, especially out on the grounds, I think there's quite a bit of non-intelligent stuff, just recordings. But I think there's some intelligent stuff out there too, that I've seen shadows and things walking around on the grounds. And the house sits on almost 3 acres, so you got a lot of property to investigate as well.
A lot of room to play around, yeah.
Yeah, and the house is a little over 5,000 square feet, so. Yeah, six levels. Yeah.
I'm gonna get lost. I'm gonna get locked in a closet somewhere. I just know it.
but like I said, that's my hope for every team that comes in. Don't investigate the stories of the haunting. You know, don't investigate the stories of the haunting. Investigate, you know, actually see to prove to yourself, you know, that something's here.
Very good advice. And yeah, we're gonna do our best. You know, we've got a plan in mind to do exactly that. To let's just go in and see. Like, that's what's so exciting about such a new property. Like, you've investigated it, of course. You had a prior investigation with us in Trader Hill, who is awesome. I love that lady.
Yeah. She's one of my good friends.
Yeah, she's so cool. Yeah. I gotta get her back on. Yeah, we're just very excited to just see what kind of evidence can we get. We've never investigated before either, so it's going to be an interesting evening, and we're just going to take what we can get. But it is good to have the story and the foundation. Just be like, I wonder if there's anything else. All right. Well, thank you for that, and then let's hit our final segment. We'll let people know where to find you, and then we will close out the episode. So, first question. How is the Night House different than other destination investigation locations?
It's a unique house. You'll never see another house that is built like this with six different levels. You'll never find another house built like this. It is so weird and unique.
Yeah. Ugh. It's awesome, guys. Check out the pictures on the website. Just do. Question number two. If you could meet and have a sit-down discussion with any of the now past Night House residents, who and why?
It would be Eliza. She seemed like she was a force. She seemed like she was a very nice lady, but she was a force. And I think that I don't think her husband would have been as successful as he was without her. I think just the history and me diving into it, I get the sense that she was part of they were a partnership. Even though as a woman back then, she wasn't allowed to have a say per se, but I think she was a force behind her husband and why he was so successful. I think she had a huge hand in making the numbers work and all that.
Yeah.
She was a very strong woman from what the sense I've got, but yeah, her for sure.
Yeah. I've been digging Eliza today. All right. Final question. Eric, do you have plans to haunt the Night House?
I don't think I would not haunt the Night House. It's not my history to haunt. You know what I'm saying? Like, I know I own it now, but we always say, we and this is what we tell the community, and this is our motto for the Night House, is that, yeah, we own the house, but we don't own the history. Hmm. And now we're becoming part of the history of it, but the majority of my history belongs in my childhood home, which I still own. That I've lived there for almost 40 years. Other than moving out, you know, when I was young and having an apartment with some friends when I was younger, I've lived there my entire life. It was my parents' house. They both, you know, They didn't pass away in the house. My dad did, but it was their house, and it's my childhood home, so that's home. So if I haunt anywhere, it'd be that house, for sure.
Yeah. All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. Would you please let my audience know where they can find and follow you online, where they can catch the Unseen Paranormal Podcast, and where they can book an investigation?
Where am I not at? the Unseen Paranormal Podcast is everywhere. Anywhere that you're listening or watching this show, you can find the podcast. Now I do audio only. I'm kind of a traditionalist, like radio show type guy. But you can still find the show on YouTube. I do have lots of people listening on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And but yeah, Spreaker, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Google, any podcatcher. If you Google the Unseen Paranormal Podcast, the first eight pages is me in the podcast. So you should be able to find somehow to listen to the show. And I have, I'm pushing 160 something episodes with 160 something guests. I've been on hiatus because of the Night House, but actually September 25th, right before y'all get here, I'm actually releasing a new episode of the show. I've got about six pre-recorded that I'll put out. I got some really good guests I'm excited about too.
Nice.
That are coming out here soon. So the season five will come back, like I said, September 25th. And I put an episode out every Wednesday. And I'm pretty like clockwork. Other than the hiatus I've been on, I'm pretty good at putting episodes out every Wednesday. And so when people wake up in the mornings, there's a new episode of the Unseen Paranormal for you. But I got some good guests coming up. You can find me and the Unseen Paranormal on Facebook. I have a public page, so people can friend me because it's my public profile. And the Unseen Paranormal has a page on there, on Instagram, the Unseen Paranormal, and on X. Or Twitter, TikTok, I have an account, Unseen Paranormal. I have a website if you search. I haven't paid for the domain in a long time, so if you search for the Unseen Paranormal, you can find a website, which you can listen to the show on there, too. The Night House, I'm kind of starting to get it everywhere. The Night House, we do have a website for, that you can book a night at the Night House. It is thenighthouseky.com. And night is spelled K-N-I-G-H-T. And and on Facebook, you can find the Night House. I post a lot of stuff on Facebook. I don't have a Twitter or anything for the house. I just started a YouTube page where everybody can go watch the videos. So look for the Night House KY on YouTube as well. And but yeah, on the website, you can go book a history tour or you can book a paranormal tour. We have three different options for paranormal tours. We have the complete overnight, which is 14 hours from 7 p.m. to 9 a.m. the next morning. We have beds for you to sleep in, clean linens. You can even take a shower. We have towels and all that good stuff for you. And so you get the house for 14 hours with you and your a group of up to 10. And if you want a couple more people to join you, it costs a little bit extra per person for that. Mm-hmm. If you just want a half night from 7 till 3 a.m., you can have up to 8 people for the price. And then if you want two additional people, it costs a little bit more. Right now, we're running a special on both of those where you get $150 off for spooky season. So the overnight is $500 for it's $500 for up to 8 people, and then $60 a person for two more up to 10, and then it's $350 for the half night 7 to 3. And then we also are doing a mini investigation that you can schedule from 7 till 10 p.m. 3-hour guided ghost hunt. So for people that are novices or anything, you can come in the first 2 hours. I'll investigate with you and teach you how to investigate. And I've got, rim pods and stuff. So people can see the stuff they see on TV. I'll probably explain to you why I don't like it and don't use it, but I'll let you play with it nonetheless. And the last hour, people get to roam, and it's $100. They get to roam and investigate wherever they want, and I'll still be here with them. It's $100 for four people, and for two additional people, it's $25 a piece for up to six people for a private party. And then right now, we're doing private history tours that they can go on and book because We have to get the zoning changed because it's never been open to the public. So the house is zoned residential. So we have to get a conditional use permit under it being a historic landmark to sell actual tickets.
Oh.
So, we have to go in front of the Board of Zoning Appeals in the middle of October for that. So if they give us the conditional use, then we can start doing public ghost hunts and sell tickets like that and do more public things. And so that's what we're looking to do. And then eventually, the 5-year goal is to become a event venue. So putting in a parking lot and an event barn So weddings, car shows, just all kinds of different events. Maybe even like a little Paracon every year, you know?
Yeah. So. Oh, heck yeah. Right on. Well, my gosh, you've like added a lot. I think since the last I last listened to you on Damien's podcast, you've added some options there for investigators and people coming in who are just curious about just take a tour of the place. So there's lots of opportunity there, folks. Please check it out. I will be putting all of those links in the show notes of today's episode. But for now, please help me close out this episode. Would you like to leave us with any final thoughts, words of wisdom, or a piece of advice?
Yes, this is what I tell a lot of people. I in my 25 years investigating, I've never come across anything demonic. Have I come across nasty spirits? Yes. But my motto is, if you're an a-hole in life, you're probably going to be an a-hole in death. Why would your attitude change? So just because something's nasty doesn't mean it's demonic.
Paranormal investigator, podcaster, empath, night house owner, Eric Freeman Sims, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Thank you, Eric, for appearing on the show. I look forward to meeting you in person in just a couple of days. Good folks, devoted listeners, learn more about my guest at the links in the show notes. Check out the Unseen Paranormal podcast on all platforms. And if you are an investigator, consider booking your own stay at the Night House. Go to www.thenighthouseky.com. Right now, he is running a spooky season special for anyone booking a Friday night through the end of October. This would be a good time to get in there. Be sure you are following the Paranorm Girl podcast on social and subbed on YouTube at Paranorm Girl Pod. This is the easiest way to stay abreast of show developments, new episodes, and the like, and also an easy way to stay in touch with me. If you have a spooky story to share, PGP has a story recording phone line, 208-717-1655. Say your name or anonymous, where the experience took place, and then tell us your story. Again, that is 208-717-1655. If you would like to support the program in other ways, two very important ways to do so is by sharing the link to your favorite episode with a friend, or consider becoming a patron of the show. Patrons of Paranorm Girl enjoy private movie nights with moi, bonus content not seen or heard in the regular episodes, and gratis merch starting at my $10 level. Visit patreon.com/ParanormGirlPod to check out my tiers and pick the one that is going to work best for you. That will be a wrap for this week. I will see you guys back here next Tuesday following my investigation. We will be exploring different types of hauntings, what creates them, how to stop them, and then, you know, maybe a quick recap of my time in Hopkinsville and our overnight at the Night House. Going to be a great episode to kick off October. I will see you guys soon. Until then, stay safe, keep the nightlight on, and sleep with one eye open.